If I were to ask you what your goal in life is, I think that you probably all would respond a little bit differently. For some of you, your aim and goal in life is love. You want to find that person that you will love, or else you want to make sure that you maintain that love for the person that you're married to. Perhaps love is your goal in life. Maybe it's work. You're one of those strange people who enjoys work and you want to make sure that you get ahead and you keep pushing forward and achieving more. Maybe your goal in life is something to do with the home, something to do with relationships, health. Maybe it is just relaxing with friends. But you know, the ultimate goal that I believe stands behind all of those that I've already mentioned is the goal of wanting to be happy. Believe it or not, scientific studies have been done on happiness. Indeed, there has been a worldwide pool of resources regarding this concept of happiness. This year, we are told that Britain has moved up the happiness table a little bit. A few years ago, we were in the 72nd position as far as national happiness was concerned. Believe it or not, now we're up to 19th position as far as happiness is concerned. Not quite as high up as Ireland. They're at 15th place. Not as high up as America. They're at 14th place. With the Netherlands, I think it is, away up in first place. But at least we're happier than the French. They're away down the 20s somewhere, and it just confirms what I've always known, that garlic's bad for you. But for quite some time, positive psychologists have tested tens of thousands of people to see what affects their happiness. And they've looked at a number of things that could possibly bring them happiness, like money and love and health. And they've discovered when you have those three combined, money, love, and health, that it only adds on 10% to your level of happiness. How they work that out, I have no idea. But this is what they're saying. And what they've discovered is this, that most people are happiness chasers. They are looking for something else to make them happy. Many find financial success and still find that they're unhappy. Others enter into a great relationship and yet at the end of it are still dissatisfied. Others enjoy the very best of health but are still utterly miserable. And Jesus, I believe, uses the two sons to portray the two basic ways people try to find happiness and fulfillment in their lives. There is the way like the elder son of moral conformity, and the way like the younger son of self-discovery. And each tends to color the way that people view their lives and the things that they pursue in their lives. The elder brother, for example, believes that he needs to live as others would want him to live. It's all about looking good in the eyes of others. It's all about making sure that you forge ahead in life and that you make yourself something. Like the Pharisees, they were a people chosen by God, and they reckoned that they could only maintain their position and what they received by achieving salvation for themselves through the things that they were doing, by adding on extra rules and seeking to keep those rules. But the problem with this sort of route, where you feel you've always got to be doing these things to look right in the eyes of others, is that you're never sure when you have done enough. You're never sure that you have put enough things into your day, into your week, into your life to merit you or gain you salvation. The younger brother, on the other hand, well, his attitude is an attitude that says, I will live as I want. I think this is much more prevalent today in the ancient patriarchal structures. This sort of route would have been looked upon as very irregular, because most people would have tried to keep with the norm of the day. But today it's very much the way with the millennials. That's what today's generation are called. They are the millennials, and they believe that they need to be able to do what they think is right. They dislike the traditionalists, and they say, well, nobody can tell me what's right or wrong. I decide that for myself. You see, the person who follows the way of moral conformity would say, I'm not going to do what I want. I'll do what tradition says I should do, what the community expects me to do. But the guy, the younger son type, they're saying, I'm the only one who can decide. I'm the only one who can say what's right or wrong for me. How dare anyone else say that they don't agree with the choices that I have made in my life? Do you see those views prevalent in our world today? Do you see them? Where people today say, either I'll just live as everybody else lives, or else I'll do things my own way, and nobody can tell me that I am wrong. Well, Jesus' message here is to both groups of people. It is to challenge their concept of how to reach this happiness and to show them that both of these are dead ends, and that there is only one way to true satisfaction within our hearts. So I believe there's two questions come out of this morning, and we're going to look at these. First one is a very simple one. What is sin? I'm not going to ask you for the catechism definition. You'll all know that sin is any want of conformity unto or transgression of the law of God. You'll all know that. You probably know all of the catechisms that go around that. Aren't I right? You know them, don't you? Okay, tell me what they, nobody joking you. But I'm going to look at what I see to be Christ's very simple definition regarding sin, and it is perhaps a definition that many today would find a little difficult or awkward regarding this. A number of years ago, a newspaper posed the question, what's wrong with the world? And a number of people submitted different essays on what they believe to be wrong with the world. G.K. Chesterton, who was a bit of a wit, he decided that he would send an essay in. But his essay just had two words in it, two very small words. So the title was, What's Wrong with the World? And his response was, I am. And I think that's very good. Because if we want to see what's wrong with the world, it starts here. It starts within me. What is wrong with the world today is sin. You see, at the beginning of Jesus' story, it is very easy to see the younger brother's sin. It's glaringly obvious where he has gone wrong. He doesn't honor his father. As a result, he humiliates his family. He then goes out from there with the money that he receives, and he lives a self-indulgent lifestyle. It is all about I, me, mine, myself. And then as a result of the choices that he has made, he ends up in the pigsty in a far-off country, and he is alienated from his family. He sees that himself. He says whenever he works out this speech he's going to make that he's going to go back to his father and say, I'm not even worthy to come back as a servant. I just want to be a hired hand. He is alienated as a result of his sinful choices. And of course, this represents the alienation that our sin creates between us and our Heavenly Father. But the story then shifts towards the end to the elder brother. He is different to the younger one because he is totally obedient to his father. What his father asks him to do, he does it. While the younger son disappears from the farm and heads off into the far country, the elder son stays there and he continues doing the work on the land. He is obedient, and therefore by analogy it refers to those who are obedient to the commands of God. He seems to be utterly under control. He is disciplined in his lifestyle, and we kind of admire him. He's a hard-working, industrious, loyal sort of son. And we think he's the good guy, at least on the surface. And yet as we get to the end of the parable, we discover that he is just as alienated as his younger brother. That he too does not have a real relationship with the Father. Therefore, there's not just one lost son in this parable, but there's two. Two who are utterly lost. Now put yourselves just for a moment or two in the shoes of the scribes and the Pharisees who are listening to Jesus deliver this parable. I don't want you to get the wrong idea at the end of this, that everybody was kind of teary-eyed, because for sure the scribes and Pharisees were not teary-eyed at the return of the prodigal son, as we call him. They weren't thinking, this is a wonderful story because here's this guy who has lived a profligate lifestyle and he is returning home to his father. No, they weren't thinking this is something wonderful here. Instead, they would have been angry at the conclusion to the story because the morally repugnant son is the one who is saved at the end of the story, who comes home to the father. And the morally upright son is the one who is lost at the end of the parable. You see, the scribes and Pharisees wouldn't have missed that this was applying to them. I want you to see that deep down, both these brothers thought exactly the same way. What did the younger son most want in life? Well, it was clear, as we said last week, he wanted his father's things, but he didn't want what? See, I knew you were sleeping. We'll try this one again. The younger son decided that he wanted the father's things, but he didn't want the father. Thank you. The choir's with me at least. How true that is. So when we come to the elder son and we look at him and he's resentful of what the father does and in accepting the younger son home and in killing the fatted calf, and we can find him adding it all up in his mind as to how much this cost, we discover whenever he says to the father, all these years I have served you and yet you never killed a goat for me, we discover that the elder son also wants the father's things, but not the father. The two of them are actually governed by the same faulty philosophy. Both of them have exactly the same problem. One went far away to gain control over his life. The other one stayed close to home to have that control. And Jesus here is giving us a much deeper concept of sin. Most people think of sin as doing something wrong. Isn't that right? You know, you kick somebody in the shins. Well, that's a sin, particularly if it's me you kick in the shins. And we understand what sin is. You say something wrong, you do something wrong, you think something wrong. That's sin. We have no problem. And that is sin, by the way, just in case you think I'm going to tell you that's okay to do those things. No, it's not. That is sin. But really, it's one aspect of sin. Sin is something that is much more than that. Sin really at its heart is this. It is me saying, I'm not going to do things your way. I'm going to do things my way. You're not going to be in control of my life, God. I am going to be in control of my life. I am happy to accept your things, but I do not want you. Do you see where I'm going with this? And this is what Jesus is showing to be the problem here. Flannery O'Connor wrote a novel called Wise Blood. And in it, she has a character who says this. There was a deep, black, wordless conviction in him that the way to avoid Jesus was to avoid sin. So in other words, if I can manage not to do these things that are wrong in my life, I don't actually have to think about Jesus because I don't need him. And it strikes me that there are those today who do exactly that. They live a good life. On the outside, you would say that they're Christians just by the way that they live. And they maybe have even come to the point where they think that they're Christians because they do all of these good things. But the reality is that it's just so that they can avoid their real need, which is to be trusting in Jesus Christ. These, by the way, tend to be the hardest to reach with the gospel. They can't understand that their self-righteousness is not good enough to save themselves. They reckon that God somehow owes them because they come to church, they read their Bibles, they pray, they have been baptized, they have taken communion, and they think that all of these things somehow means that God owes them. And they want the things, but not the relationship with the Father. Are you with me? I'm trying to make sure you stay with me through this one today. So they think that they should have a ticket to heaven. I wonder, is this the attitude of your life? If it is, I want you today to realize that what you need is what Jesus offers us. When Jesus was asked what the greatest commandment was, do you remember what he said? He said it is to what? Love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, strength, and mind. And to love your neighbor as yourself. Boys, the day is right in front of you on the screen. You maybe thought I was trying to trick you there. I really wasn't. So we are told that we are to love. You see, the whole point of Christianity is not about this list of do's and don'ts, and people have got stuck in this over the years. It is not about this list of do's and don'ts, but it is about a relationship with the Father through Jesus Christ. That's what it's about. When we have that right relationship, we will want to serve him. We will want to work on the farm, as it were. We will want to be doing things that please him. But we do them not begrudgingly thinking that God owes us. We do them because we want to please the one that we love. It's kind of why you husbands will go the extra mile for your wives. Isn't that right? You know, it comes to their birthday and you get them a card and it says in the card, I love you so much that I would do anything in the whole world for you. And she says, go and empty the bins, and you say, don't take advantage. And when we love God with all of our hearts, it means that we will do everything that we can out of a heart that is filled with love. Let me ask you today, do you love God? Are you in a relationship with God? For sure, both of these sons had broken that. I've spent longer on that than I intended to. I want to just tell a wee story at the end of this point about, you'll know this story. You know who that is, don't you, in the picture? You see, I knew you didn't. Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart. And I'm sure you could quote me all of his greatest hits, couldn't you? Well, anyway, there was another character that's in the story of Mozart, and that is his nemesis, Salieri. And there's a wonderful story about this. Salieri makes a deal with God. And he says to God, Lord, make me a great composer. Let me celebrate your glory through my music and be celebrated myself. Make me famous through the world, dear God. Make me immortal. After I die, let people speak my name forever with love for what I wrote. In return, I vow I will give you my chastity, my industry, my deepest humility every hour of my life, and I will help my fellow man all I can. And so he begins, under this vow, to live his life, this honorable, upright, decent life. And everything goes well. And Salieri does begin to make this life for himself, where he becomes renowned because of his wonderful music. And everything goes well until Mozart comes along. his musical gifts far outweigh Salieri's. But he is as vulgar and disgusting in his lifestyle as Salieri was saintly in his. Salieri later said, "It was incomprehensible. Here I was denying all my natural lust in order to deserve God's gift, and there was Mozart indulging his in all directions, even though engaged to be married, and no rebuke at all." Finally, Salieri says to God, "From now on, we are enemies, you and I." And thereafter he resolved that he would destroy Mozart. The same problem existed with Salieri as with the older brother. Everything they did was for themselves, not for any other great or grand purpose. It was for themselves. Whenever Salieri lived that almost monasterial lifestyle, it was for himself and his glory, not for God. And when the elder son in this story does everything on the farm that he should, it's not because of a relationship with the father, but it's for himself. Tim Keller says, "Elder brothers obey God to get things. They don't obey God to get God himself, in order to resemble him, love him, know him, and delight him." Christ here shows us that sin is more than just doing or thinking or saying things that are wrong, but it's an attitude of heart. It's an attitude of heart that denies God and sets ourselves on the throne. What is sin? And briefly, I promise you it is, what is salvation? For those of you who are parents, you know what you need to do whenever your child disobeys you, don't you? What do you do whenever your child disobeys you? Who can tell me? Okay, none of you want to say it. I can read your minds. Okay, and as I stand here this morning, some of you are thinking, "I'll tell them off." There's two of you who are thinking that. Some of you are thinking, "I'll take things off them." One of you is thinking that. And all the rest of you are thinking, "I'll smack them." Isn't that right? Yeah, honestly, it's as well I'm not a policeman. But you know, we understand the principle well. We punish the child for what they do that's wrong, and then we confirm our love for them later. I can remember my parents doing this with me. I still don't believe that it hurt my dad more than it hurt me. But that was the line anyway. And we understand this concept, and both of these sons were wrong in their dealings with the father, but here we find that they are equally loved. One of them, we find, the father gives him his possessions, and then whenever he comes back, he throws his arms around him and he throws a party for him. And the other son, we discover, the father comes out of the party and he says to him, "Come into the party." He invites him to the party as well. Both sons are invited to his love feast. Jesus here is teaching that happiness is to be found in neither of the approaches that are found here. It's not to be found in religion, which is like the elder son who lives this good life, nor in irreligion like the younger son. It's not to be found in morality or immorality, nor is it to be found in legalism nor liberalism. Salvation is not found in those things. Both of these sons show us this. So where is it to be found? Well, it's to be found in the gospel. It's to be found in and through the Lord Jesus Christ. The message that Jesus gives us in Luke 18 verse 14 is, "The humble are in and the proud are out." So when do we find that younger son being welcomed back home? Well, when he has this attitude that comes into his heart that says, "I am wrong. I want to be accepted home but I don't deserve to be accepted home. And his attitude has changed. He develops a humility. On the other hand, we see this haughty spirit of the elder brother as he stands outside the room where the feast is taking place and refuses to go in. Happiness therefore begins when we're able to confess that we are not good enough. Indeed, that we have broken God's law innumerable times. You see, it is all about Jesus. Although the sons are both wrong and both loved, sadly the story does not end the same for each. One receives forgiveness and restoration, whilst the other shows a son in whom there is this stubborn, inward, rebellious spirit. Now let me ask you, what about you today? Maybe you're someone and you've come to church and you've gone through all the organizations and you've read the Bible. Indeed, you probably know the Bible better than most of the elders. But yet, there's no relationship with the Lord in your life. And today you see that you need Jesus. You see, it's all about him. Today the good news is he can save your soul. Or maybe you're like this openly rebellious younger brother and you're pursuing your way in life and well dare anybody tell you that you're wrong. But today you see that that rebellion is going to lead you to destruction. And you need Christ. Even where you sit in the pew today, why not bow your head and ask Jesus to forgive you? Because if you really mean it, he will forgive you and he will save your soul. Or maybe you're a Christian and you're far from God today and you see you need to come back. Will you do so today? Don't put it off, but come near to God. I'm going to close our service.